We recently asked a couple hundred of you emerging biotech leaders about your go-to sources of information when you face tough professional challenges. Your top response wasn't webinars, it wasn't scientific journals, it wasn't trade shows, it wasn't even consultants. Far and away, you said you most often turn to your peers for trusted insight. Enabling a community of peers is what the Business of Biotech podcast is all about. It's also what our new Business of Biotech newsletter is all about. Peer-driven content, no strings attached, delivered to your inbox once a month. Go to bioprocessonline.com/BOB to subscribe. The Business of Biotech is produced by Bioprocess Online, part of the Life Science Connect community, with support from Cytiva. Cytiva also demonstrates its commitment to the leaders of new and emerging biopharma at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Check that out. Welcome back to the Business of Biotech. I'm Matt Piller, and today's recording finds me in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, visiting an exciting young biotech called Blue Sphere Bio, and its recently appointed CEO, Kier Loiacono. Kier, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. Also joining me as guest host today is my colleague, fellow Bioprocess Online editor and Pittsburgher, recent transplant, John O'Connell, executive editor at Bioprocess Online.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, indeed. I am a transplant. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you help me interrogate Kier. By the way, for those listeners who are familiar with Bioprocess Online, who came across the Business Biotech podcast by way of Bioprocess Online, if you ever had an interest in writing and being a guest columnist and contributing to our editorial efforts, the way that you see other guest columnists do, John O'Connell is the guy you want to talk to.
Absolutely, Matt. Yeah, our guest editor space, our guest columnist space is a really important arena where people can talk to and hear from their peers. I like to think of it as sort of a town hall or a town center where people can get together and share ideas.
Yeah. So we'll get past that shameless plug. Thank you for indulging. We just wrapped up a tour, Kier, of your facilities here. And I got to tell you, I'm super impressed. It's a beautiful building. It's a great, beautiful facility. Right down the road from us here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We built this space out. We finished it a little over a year ago. So I started, I just had my 2-year anniversary at Blue Sphere. When I started, the space that you see out here today was a fraction of it. Only one of the labs existed. So we more than tripled the size of our labs and our space here. We also have space on the first floor in this building. And we're part of this emerging biotech hub that's in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed on my way in fact, that Nubase is in this building as well. And Dietrich Stefan was one of my early guests, CEO over there at Nubase.
Great.
I think they're like right downstairs.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're downstairs. So he was an early guest on the Business of Biotech.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Very nice. You have an interesting background in that you started out in bio. You got a bio undergrad, correct?
I do.
Yeah. And then, and you worked in bio for a little bit before you went to get your law degree?
I did. My undergrad was in bio from New York, Manhattan College, and then kind of realized it was pretty tough to find a job with a bio degree, unless you're going to go on to get your PhD or some higher education in the field. So I sent out a whole bunch of resumes and became a pharma rep with, again, a young startup. We were selling an antibiotic. I had no idea how to sell anything. It was a new indication for a new drug we marketed to dentists. And they basically threw us our territory list and an expense account and a couple of marketing materials. And they said, go build a business.
Yeah.
And we did. And about a year in, we sold the company to Johnson & Johnson. And I stayed there for about 7 years. And somewhere in a couple of years in, decided that liked business, but rather than go to business school, I guess in an effort to be different, I went to law school at night while I worked for kind of moved up through the sales ranks there at J&J and went to law school at night.
Yeah. When you were going to law school and you were spending that time in the pharma in Jersey, right?
New York.
New York.
I was in New York.
So you're close to, you know, what was at the time a burgeoning pharma, you know, pharma environment. Was it your intention when you were in law school to lawyer in the pharma life sciences?
It was not. It was to, it was to use the law degree to become an executive, and thought I would stay at Johnson & Johnson actually. And, about halfway through, interesting, you know, I'm a patent attorney. That's where I started my career. I don't think I'd ever even seen a patent until my, you know, second year of law school, and realized that, you know, because I had a science background, that was a route for me. So I kind of switched directions and thought, okay, maybe I'll be, you know, maybe I'll be a lawyer for, you know, instead of staying in the business route. So, finished law school, stayed at J&J right up until I graduated, and then got a job with at the time it was the largest, I think it probably still is the largest IP law firm in New Jersey, Cordler & David.
And during that time at the firm, you did work in life sciences.
I did. Almost exclusively. I spent a lot of time in the med tech, molecular diagnostic, and I guess you could say immuno-oncology, although I don't think we called it immuno-oncology then, on deals. And most of my practice, I would say, was focused on transactional work and litigation. So we did a lot of deal work, a lot of due diligence, mostly on the buy side, because we were typically representing larger clients, but some on the sell side also.
Yeah. From there, you went on to in-house counsel for AdvaXis.
Yes. Correct?
So correct. Why'd you leave the firm and go back in-house?
So I was in my sixth or seventh year, and was probably a year or two away from partner, and got, you know, probably a lot of people's story. I was working late one night, and my partner looked at me and said, "Hey, you've got like a lump on your shoulder." So I wound up having a primary bone cancer.
Really?
And, and I had been, you know, doing the grind. I had two little kids and a wife, and, you know, I was like, "Wait, what?" You know, I was never saw them, and kind of looked around.
You had not noticed this, but your coworker did.
Yeah, because it was just like a subtle thing, right? You know, you wouldn't think at the time. You thought like, "Oh, maybe I got hurt at the gym or something like that." And so, you know, I knock on wood, it's like 7 years now, but had surgery. Brilliant doctor at Yale, guy by the name of Gary Friedlander. My best friend is a surgeon at Yale, and the head of the chair of orthopedics at Yale at the time was an orthopedic oncologist, which is a super rare field. And my mother's a 10-year multiple myeloma survivor. But that was really my only experience with cancer up until that point, you know, and fortunately with myeloma, it's manageable, you know, almost chronically now, at least for a lot of patients.
Yeah.
So this was like, you can imagine, right? Like a huge awakening. And so, yeah, went to Yale, got treated, was really like inspired, by this particular doctor, this guy who's, you know, in his early 80s now and still operating.
Dr. Friedman.
Friedlander. Gary Friedlander. Okay. Yeah. He is the thought leader for sarcoma, soft bone and musculoskeletal sarcomas. But I didn't really know that much about cancer. I'd spent a lot of time in cardiovascular, some in orthopedics, some cancer, but like it was kind of eye opening to me. And I thought, you know, I'm going to use this. Right. And I looked around the law firm, and I was chasing the carrot like everybody does, you know, and seeing all the partners in their Porsches and, you know, and I'm like, oh, I want that. I decided. So I rolled the dice and sent out my resume, and I wanted to work at an oncology company. So I took, I wound up at AdvaXis. It was a short period, you know, between my diagnosis and surgery, and then getting into AdvaXis, where I took over as their head of IP. And so I think that makes me manage differently I think, than others with a, you know, a little bit of a mission, you know,
sure.
And there are, when we interview people, we say, and it's the truth, you know, we've gotten really good at some cancers and we haven't done anything in others. And, you know, particularly for later diagnoses. And so we do what we do and I do what I do because every day there's patients who are like right now, right? We're sitting here in this awesome building and we're talking and drinking coffee. And, you know, there's people whose doctors are telling them that, you know, their scans don't look good, their cancer's back, and they've already been through 2, 3, 4 lines of treatment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, success rates of biotech companies are not high in terms of getting drugs approved, right? It's when you look at the stats, you think, God, why would anybody do that? But we do, because if we don't, then, you know, and it's not just cancer, right? It's rare diseases. It's cardiology. It's neuro, which, you know, is probably needs a lot of advancement, but you need people like who will run through a wall, even though they know that they've, you know, the chance of not making it through the wall of getting a drug through. But even if you can get a drug into a clinic and help those patients, I think, you know, so.
Well, thanks for sharing that story. Yeah. This is, these are the angles and hooks that I expect PR people to tell me before I get into the interview. I didn't know I wasn't aware. It is inspiring though. You know, even rarer than the lawyer CEO is the CEO who has such a personal connection.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and then what you realize is there's a whole network of clinicians and scientists and PR people who, you know, they all have similar stories, right? But, people need cures. They at least need options, right? You know, it's funny when you talk about what gets drugs approved and you talk about progressive disease and complete responses and partial responses. As a drug developer, it gets frustrating sometimes, right? Because you see, all right, well, we have a disease control rate, which means, you know, your tumor didn't grow, but it didn't go away. Well, in most cases, that's not enough for approval. Mm-hmm. But for that patient, if your tumor doesn't grow for 2 years, that's a win.
Yeah.
Right. So there's like a policy part of what we do. That part is frustrating.
Yep. When you made that move to Advaxis, you worked in patent. Mm-hmm. Was it your intention then, because all of a sudden you were inspired internally and mission driven, was it your intention to sort of use that as you know, the entree and then work your way into management?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had always had a business sense. It kind of came from my sales experience. And, you know, I always say, like, I think everybody in their life should either wait tables, wash dishes, or have to sell something for at least 3 months of their life to understand what it's like to, you know, have to be able to produce before they came home. So I think I've always been driven. I think I probably always wanted to, you know, from that point, wanted to be a CEO, but was put into a situation at Advaxis, which was a public company with active clinical trials and growth and raising money. And I, you know, could have connected myself to the CEO and the CFO at that time and just kind of forced myself in the room when I could get into the room just to learn about all of these different things. People ask me that, you know, like, how do you go from being a patent lawyer, a drug rep, to running a company? And I think I tell people, if that's what you want to do, you know, do what you have to do to get in the room.
Yeah.
And then keep your mouth shut and take notes.
Yeah.
And so do that as long as that's what I did.
You did that at Advaxis. You did that next at OncoSec after Advaxis.
So did a bunch of deals, learned a bunch of stuff, you know, a bunch of skills. I didn't know anything about the business side of biotech when I started at Advaxis. And, you know, we did several deals, dilutive and non-dilutive, several capital raises, lawsuits, you know, all of the things that come along with, you know, being at a public biotech company. And my experience, by the way, is on the public side. Bluesphere is my first private venture. And I had an opportunity to then go to OncoSec and take on a business development and broader legal role. So I was the head of business development and general counsel there. I became the general counsel after, you know, after a while. And then I don't remember exactly how much, but we raised probably over $100 million in within a couple of years, through a series of different types of raises. And again, that there I, you know, there I had even more direct exposure to, kind of the inner workings of our industry and finance and banking and what it takes to raise money. But also a lot on the clinical side, right? Cause so much of, I have a, you know, I know before the podcast, we were talking about JP Morgan. Yeah. And I have, obviously our industry has been, you know, it's always wrought with volatility, but it's been particularly volatile, lately.
Yeah.
And the, you know, we had a good couple of years financially, the industry did during COVID, I think, you know, which is expected. And now we're on the backside of that. And I think the one thing that the one common currency of all biotech is data and how you design your clinical development programs, you know, and your programs, you have to design them in a way that allow you to keep promising programs going that you can finance, because that's just a reality of what we do. Yeah. Is, you know, we need money to do what we do, and that money comes in a lot of forms. And the more sound your strategy is, and the more sound your programs are, and the more you can get to patients, the easier it is to finance. In the absence of data, or in the absence of the promise of data coming quickly, it's hard to do what we do. And that was a big learning for me at OncoSec. Mm-hmm. When I was there, because I really had a chance to be involved in the design and redesign of, you know, clinical trials. So
yeah. Yeah, you mentioned JPM. One of the through lines coming out of the event, I think, is maybe I don't want to say that many of the deals landed with a thud, but data is being cited sort of as the issue, right? Like there's not as much transactional activity taking place as many may have anticipated, capital markets notwithstanding.
Yeah,
because there haven't been a whole lot of terrific data readouts.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think there's a lot of noise in our industry, you mm-hmm. know, like there is, and it's a speculative industry, right? It's not, you know, if you take med tech, for example, it's more incremental. It's a lot easier to get a product approved. It's easier to transact. It's, you right. know, you get to commercial pretty quickly. It's revenue generated. You know, you also have to measure expectations on what your data is going to be. And, you know, I think like within our own particular industry of cell therapy, the approval of CAR T in hematologic indications with such impressive cure rates in patients set the bar so high, right? And which is amazing for those patients. But when you start to look at solid tumor indications and checkpoints, yeah, which is the, you know, I think it'd be difficult to argue that the discovery of checkpoint inhibition therapy is not, you know, it's been the greatest advance in oncology in the last 10 or 20 years. I think it'd be hard for somebody to credibly disagree with that, at least on a large scale. But it still doesn't help, you know, and they're up to, I don't know, 30, 40 indications, something like that across at least the two leaders. And there's other follow-ons. But, you know, it only helps like 40 or 50%. You probably want to double check me on the stat, but it's probably pretty close. So like what happens to the rest of those patients, and what's a meaningful response rate? Is a 20% a meaningful response rate? Is a 40% a meaningful response rate? So when you talk about data and lack of data, I think it's important for, the drug development companies to set what the right expectation is for that data and why.
Yeah.
And you know, in our, there's different approaches, and I'm always impressed when I see people go after indications that nobody's ever heard of before, even though it's commercially risky. So, Adaptimmune, is likely going to file their BLA this year. They're a TCR T cell therapy. They could be the first, TCR T cell therapy approved in solid tumors. And their lead indication will be something called synovial sarcoma, which is an ultra rare soft tissue sarcoma that forms in the synovial joints, and it's a tiny indication. But they're going to get they're hopefully going to get an approval there, right? So that's one path, you know. Or you could go after lung cancer, where it's, you know, a lot more patients, a lot more commercially attractive. So I think as drug developers, we have to make a choice there.
Yeah.
I think we've made, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I think we've made a strategic choice in our initial indications here to kind of hit something in the middle, which is high risk leukemias, which most of those patients, if they fail initial chemotherapy, and they're either not the then at that point the curative therapy is stem cell transplant, and that's a very intense treatment regimen for these patients. They go through ablative and conditioning regimens that you know, a lot of patients are too sick and don't make it to transplant.
I think we're
kind of in a sweet spot in terms of being drug developers and hopefully being able to generate data, right? Kind of coming full circle to the original question of how do you get data? You know, I think you have to pick a meaningful indication.
Yeah.
And meaningful can mean different things.
There's a lot of, there's probably a lot of business decision-making that goes into the indications that you chase. You were mentioning, you know, Adaptimmune chasing an ultra rare indication, and then lung cancer, you know, giant indication. The implications of making those indication decisions are probably pretty serious, right? For an emerging biotech, a private company, because some indications are considerably more expensive to chase than others, right?
Yeah, and I think it also depends. I'm not a scientist, you know. I have a science background. I know science, but I don't call myself a scientist. I think it also depends on what your technology is, right? And what those indications are. There's cold tumors and then there's hot tumors, right? Certain lung cancers, melanoma, they're considered hot tumors. They have, you know, high mutational burdens. They may be easier to target depending on what your treatment is. So I think you have to know what your technology is and what it has a reasonable chance of working in. And then you have to look at your indications and decide, you know, I think in reality, probably the smart thing to do is to start small and put points up on the board.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you put points up on the board, meaning if you can get to patients and show meaningful response rates with durability, that's what it's all about. Right. And I think coming from a public company where you're always worried about supporting a stock price, right? You know, I mean, in essence, we do the same thing in private companies now, but not on a daily basis. And so, you know, the little wins are important because when you deliver on what you promise around when you say you're going to deliver, I say around in air quotes.
Yeah.
That shows people that that shows the world, right? That you're actually capable of doing what you say you're going to do as a management team and that your technology is capable of doing it. So if you get the small indication first, then you can start to look. I mean, that's what they've done with Keytruda and Opdivo, right? They started with one or two and now they're up to almost 40 and they're in first line, second line, third line, you know, and they just like dominoes. They just keep one after the other getting in different indications. Like that's the way for me, that's the way to build a franchise, right? Around something. But again, it depends on what your indication is.
Yeah. Right?
There are rare disease companies. So I give a ton of credit to, you know, going after things that they know is not going to develop beyond, you know, 500 patients or 1,000 patients globally. Those are like the true, those are the true gutsy drug developers out there, I think.
Yeah. 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 I was just thinking about the cost paradigm. That's a completely different discussion.
Yeah.
The cost paradigm with those ultra rare indications, especially in cell therapy.
Yeah.
We'll save that for another day.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a philosophical, discussion.
That's not what we came here to talk about. John, I don't want to bulldoze here. I see you taking notes over there. If you have follow-ups, you're welcome.
No, you're good.
Jump in. Yeah. And I can tell that you're anxious to talk about the technology and Blue Sphere, and that's where I want to go.
Yeah.
So I want to transition there, but we're just going to slow down the transition just a little bit.
Sure.
Cause I'm interested in Blue Sphere's origin story.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, it's great to be down here in Pittsburgh. It's great to see this facility, you know, this technology drive here that we're on, the growth that's taking place down here. Blue Sphere was founded, I think, in 18, correct?
Officially in 2018.
In 18. Yeah. You've been with the company since early 21.
We're in 2023. So
yeah.
I had to think for a second because it's January. Yeah. 21.
Yeah.
So I just had a 2-year anniversary.
Yeah. So, I mean, even in 21, you joined the company when it was relatively new. Mm-hmm. Share with us what you can about sort of the origin story of the company and then your decision to make the move into.
Yeah. Yeah. The technology that we use for discovering T cell receptors, and the initial clinical indication was born out of two brothers who were both at the University of Pittsburgh, the Schlomchicks, Mark and Warren. And they had a, so the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has its own investment fund called UPMC Enterprises. They are our sole investor, mm-hmm. And have invested over $100 million into our company.
When I first started, just interrupt you real quick.
Yeah.
When I first started covering this space a few years ago, I interviewed Chad Deemer, business development at UPMC Enterprises.
Okay.
Not the business development guy you're working with.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I'm assuming he's still there. But anyway, I wrote a piece on UPMC Enterprises, investment capabilities in Pittsburgh and beyond.
Yeah.
So another shameless plug, if you're listening and interested in UPMC Enterprises, Google them up on Bioprocess Online. You can read all about it.
But great.
You were.
Yeah. No, so I had joined. We had about 20 employees, and I was ready to do something different, and had just come off at OncoSec of a long, arduous deal that took a very long time to close, which we could probably spend 2 hours if you ever, you know, want to know the ins and outs of how boards and shareholder lawsuits work. But
I might take you up on that.
Yeah. Oh,
we'll do an episode dissecting that.
That would be very interesting. But that just so you know, that punchline is we won the lawsuits and we funded the company and we closed the deal. So that was the good part. But I was ready to do something different. And I think I was ready to do something more aspirational. And, you know, we were running pivotal programs there. You know, I came here and it was kind of, I got a call and it was kind of strange to me because I said, okay, so let me get, they were about to close $105 million Series B round, the entirety of which was taken by UPMC Enterprises. And I said, I just don't understand this. What do you mean you only have one investor and it's a private company? It was kind of strange. But I looked at the founders who were, you know, well-known scientists, physicians, and I looked at the advisory board, you know, which included Carl June, and I looked at the board of directors, which included Alan Corman, who was one of the inventors of checkpoint therapy. And I thought, like, I don't know, this could be the real deal. And, you know, I had done a little bit of work in the cell therapy space. So it was just interesting and it was unique and it was, you know, so I kind of took the leap, came over to run business development. So. Mm-hmm.
Chief Business Officer, you joined us.
I joined as the Senior Vice President of Business Development and Strategy. And then I think there was a recognition that the companies like operations and, you know, non-technical operations and G&A needed finance, all that needed to be built out. So I got promoted, I think, fairly quickly to Chief Business Officer and built out all of those functions. So in addition to business development.
When you're striving to excel in a new arena, the best guides are the ones already doing it well. The Business of Biotech brings those voices forward to help new and emerging biopharmas turn their innovations, like mRNA and cell and gene therapies, into clinical realities. Tune in and subscribe for insights on hiring, regulatory, and other need-to-know topics for biopharma leaders. The podcast is brought to you in collaboration with Cytiva. Check out their resources at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. That's cytiva.com/emerging biotech.
When you're looking for a change like that, and you've been working in, law firms are a comfortable place to work, relatively recession proof, right?
Yes. Yes.
Working in public companies for a couple stints, looking for a change. 2021. I mean, you know, maybe we didn't see the bubble about to pop in 21, but even without that foresight, it had to be a little bit uncomfortable.
I think it was uncomfortable at first, and we were in the middle of COVID, so like the whole world was just weird. You know, I was traveling, you know, prior to COVID, I was on a plane every week. We were, always in cap fundraising mode and meeting with investors and bankers, presenting at conferences and, running our trials and visiting sites. And like all of a sudden that just came to the work didn't come to a halt, but that lifestyle came to a halt. Mm. I think when I knew, this is funny, I remember, I won't mention any names, but, which reminds me, I have to call him, but my first investor call in COVID, you know, we would go to New York and we would wear suits, right? Usually not ties, but we would wear suits. We got on a call with one of our investors and he's in a Grateful Dead tie dye with like his, he hadn't shaved in 3 days and his hair was a mess. And I felt like, oh, like stuff's really changed.
So this is what we're doing now.
You know, I always say when you're the one writing the checks, you can wear whatever you want. But that's when I could still see him sitting there with his blue tie-dyed Grateful Dead shirt on. Yeah. So I knew it had changed, and I think the world had just gotten weird then. New job. But it worked. And then I think, you know, I don't think that anyone thought that like that biotech run was going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, somewhat serendipitously joining Blue Sphere when I did was wound up being really fortunate. I've had a lot of major shareholders over the years, and I'll tell you that, and it's not because they're our investor now, but they're a tremendous investor, enterprises. They are very smart, very rational, very long-term. And so it kind of gave us I think one of the things I didn't mention. To put a fine point on it, it wound up being a good move. And I think actually a less stressful move than had I stayed in the public markets. I think one of the things that impressed me about one of the things that drew me here was, you know, when you're always, depends on the level of company you are, right? But there's so many biotech companies that are in the OncoSec, Blue Sphere space, right? Where they have a promising technology, they're trying to generate data, and they're like scrapping for money, right? And you see these like terrible financings that are done. But it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, one of the first lessons I learned was you take the money when it's on the table and you fund the company and you worry about it later. We didn't have to do that here when we joined. It was like, it was one investor's money with a vision who had invested in a story and in a vision. And the idea of being able to build a company around the foundational like premise of the science and the clinical promise without designing a clinical program with inflection points to get to the next raise was really refreshing to me. So,
yeah.
Does proximity to UPMC Enterprises, does that kind of feed into why you chose or why the company has chosen to stay here in Pittsburgh?
I think that's one of the reasons. I think it's less about enterprises that it is about what Pittsburgh has to offer, you know, as an emerging biotech hub. I think certainly their investments into business and UPMC's presence in general here, but their vision on the investment side, you know, you've got Pitt and Carnegie Mellon and Duquesne, you know, you've got a world-class healthcare center here. It's affordable, right? It has all of the trappings to become a really strong hub. You know, a company recently announced that, you know, kind of long-term plans to develop a big cell manufacturing facility here in Pittsburgh. So I think it's, you know, it's not a mandate, right? Like that you have to stay in Pittsburgh because you're owned essentially by UPMC. I think it's we like being here, right? And everybody who comes here is like, wow, this is, you know, we had some finance folks in yesterday from New York. And they were like, this, you know, they like it here.
Yeah. The view out the back door, the back window of the office.
Yeah.
So this building for the listener, for listeners' benefit, is on the Mon, as it's affectionately known here in Pittsburgh, the Mon.
I get you might know better than me on that, but the Monongahela.
The Monongahela River.
I have to Google it.
That's so correct.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. We'll turn to that.
I know it's the Monongahela.
Pittsburgh resident. I mean, it's just a giant pane of windows, and you feel like you're on a balcony directly above the water. Yes. Beautiful view of the bridges. It's a pleasant place to be, even on a gloomy winter day.
It's pretty gloomy today.
Yeah,
it's pretty gloomy today. You know, I think it works for us right now, and we've been able to attract a lot of talent, especially on the science side here. We do have some remote employees, but I think we're probably like 2/3, you know, Pittsburgh based, 1/3 non Pittsburgh based. Mm-hmm. I personally live in New Jersey, but I commute in just about every week to the office, just so I can be here. But I think we really like what they're doing, and I've not to recycle what I've said in a previous written interview, but it's worth repeating for people who don't know Pittsburgh. You know, there's this juxtaposition of old and new, right? So you're talking about the view, and it's like, I sit here and literally behind me, we have this like state-of-the-art lab with automation and robots and cell therapy manufacturing going on. As I'm watching a coal barge go up a river, you know, and I'm sitting in a location that was next to where a steel mill used to be.
Yeah.
You know, this strip of land with the train tracks underneath us that runs along the river was all steel.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's just cool to me as like, you know, I'm a New Yorker. I went to college in the Bronx, you know, so I like cities, and this one feels, you know, that you can still feel like the old, but you can still feel the new also that kind of, but not, it's not replacing it. It's sort of like the next generation of innovation, if you will. So that part of it is neat. I think that story underlines Pittsburgh.
It is a cool story. You know, and when you say old, it's like, I think about Philadelphia and how folks on this side of the state generally think of Philadelphia as though it's a city in New Jersey, mm-hmm. sort of a different, you know, different culture, different vibe. And it's old. Pittsburgh's old is like a hardworking, more recent old, you know, the steel city.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 And it changed, right? Like that's where the, you know, I think that's what built Pittsburgh, right? Was largely, right? Was steel, but I think biotech and, you know, hopefully we make this success and, you know, kind of really helped to put it on the map.
So let's talk about the tech platforms. We, like I said, we just got this tour, that was phenomenal. So I want you to kind of walk us through what we saw and what's going on back there
Sure.
in the lab. Yeah. I'll let you start. You know, TC Express, Neo Express. I'll let you start where you see fit.
We're an emerging drug development company, and at the heart of that is an engine that we call TC Express that can discover TCRs, which are T cell receptors. For listeners who may not know, they're the T cells are the cells in your body that help to kill things that don't belong there, and they have receptors on them that are specific for certain targets in the body, and so our underlying platform mines for those in a high throughput and super efficient way, and then we're able to take those TCRs from one side of our lab and transfer them to the product development side, where we're able to turn them into, we're able to take those TCRs, isolate them, and then put them into an engineered T cell that are specific. You know, we engineer them to be one, safer, and to be armed specifically with the TCR that was discovered, or TCRs that were discovered from our platform.
The lab space here just recently enjoyed the benefit of some upgraded equipment.
Yes.
And during my tour, your tour guides were telling us a little bit about the actual the install, right?
Yes.
I heard that you said no to take out some windows and use a crane.
Yes.
Obviously I wish we could have took some video to include in the distribution of the podcast, but since we can't do that.
Yeah.
Illustrate it for us, for our listeners. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the process is a complex one with a lot of steps, right? It from getting the cells, TCRs, you know, single well plates, pipettes. It's a multi-step process, and so it requires, if you did it manually, it would require a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of people. So we think one of our advantages, we have it at least a large part of that process fully automated. And some of that includes the need to use viruses to get, you know, parts of the product into the next part of the product. Mm-hmm. So we had smaller enclosures, and it was kind of the vision that we would have this large scale enclosure that could do, you know, like the first 8 steps of 16 steps. I don't know if I have the numbers exactly right. In one fully automated, you know, robotic thing. So if you could picture a structure that, like, I actually wish I had a shed that was as big as this steel. Yeah. It's this beautiful steel and glass, you know, square that sits in the middle of our lab. It has to be, you know, 20 by 15, something like that. It's like this massive, and that's just the enclosure that houses all of this sophisticated molecular biology equipment, cell sorters, centrifuges, multiple robot arms to carry pipettes and samples from one. So this thing weighs, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds. And we had just finished the construction on the building and kind of, you know, figured out where this massive piece of technology was going to go. And the person who was running the program at the time decided to move it. But like, you can't just move, you know, I don't know how much it weighs, but it's thousands. Like, we needed a crane to get it in, and, you know, we had teams on site. So we actually had to structurally reinforce the steel, you know, and this is a big building we're in, right? It's like a 7-story, 8-story, like commercial glass building. Mm-hmm. We had to reinforce the steel underneath to bring this thing in. And they said, well, we can take windows out, but then, so at some point we had to cap it and say, no, you're going to put it there. We're not going to take any windows out, so we don't have to close the street and file a permit with the city of Pittsburgh.
Right.
To bring a crane in for this piece of equipment.
So. Well, that and keep the neighbors happy. I mentioned earlier that Newbase and Dietrich Safan are on the floor below you. I'm sure he probably.
Yeah.
You want to minimize the disruption.
Right. Or have them come up and look because they want to see who has the new shiny object in their lab. Right.
Right. So. Yeah. Yeah. If you could give us some indication as to what your preclinical pipeline strategy looks like, maybe talk a little bit about the two. You know, when I first looked at it, I was kind of intrigued. You know, it's like you have two separate pipelines almost.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it feels. And, you know, that's a different way to present, I guess, from most. Mm-hmm. So maybe walk us through those two and what they intend to do.
Yeah. You know, we will likely be adding a third development program to bridge between the first and second. Let me just say, you know, my belief with, you know, when you have a core underlying technology, it's better to not only have one clinical development program. And, you know, you have to be able to pay for those programs and they're expensive, but I think having more than one clinical program in your pipeline at a time is important. And so, we have a lead indication, which is high risk leukemias, AML, ALL and MDS. And then on the further end of our pipeline, we have a fully, what will be a fully personalized, TCR T cell therapy program, directed to solid tumors, which I'll talk about. And then, sometime in the first quarter of this year, we'll announce a third, solid tumor indication, bridging, the leukemia study and the, kind of earlier stage, individualized TCR T cell therapy program that right now we call TCX201. So if I start at the beginning, you know, we have, we're targeting high risk leukemia, which I mentioned earlier, AML, and ALL and MDS, which are high risk diseases. I'll focus more on AML. I think there's about 20,000 cases a year of AML and in excess of 20,000 cases a year. You know, I think only about 3,000 patients actually get transplanted. Now that doesn't mean that, you know, everybody succumbs to their disease, but, you know, some of those patients can have multiple remissions with chemotherapy, but the regimen to get a patient to a transplant is pretty taxing. And, I think the average age of diagnosis for, AML is like mid to late 60s. Mm. So when you have patients who come in with those diseases, you know, who could also have comorbidities, it's hard to get those patients. It's hard to, you know, get those patients to transplant. And so there's an unmet need there of how do you manage these patients? And one of the, you know, I think one of the challenges with the traditional stem cell transplant, allogeneic stem cell transplant, is that, you know, you have these like two components. One's referred to as GVHD, graft versus host disease, mm-hmm. and the other is graft versus leukemia. And, you know, GVHD is sort of this, like, I think if you think about it in lay terms, it's like rejection, right? If you think of like an organ transplant, you say like, oh, they rejected the heart. Or like,
yeah.
It's a similar concept. It's different biology, but it's a similar concept. And so when you give the patient all of the cells, which include the donor's T cells, it's those T cells that kill the patient's leukemia, but it's also those T cells that can attack the other parts of the patient's body. So there are types of transplants that are given where you can delay the T cell infusion and just give stem cells. So after you deplete all of their bone marrow through these conditioning induction regimens, the stem cells grow back and they repopulate. But in those scenarios, what you get is relapse of the leukemia. So you've made a safer transplant, but those patients relapse.
Yeah.
We have this very elegant approach, in how we treat And there may be one or two others who are in this space, but everyone does it differently. Ours is based on what's called a CD34 selected transplant. So an unrelated donor donates blood cells, and we separate out stem cells, which are cells that kind of haven't grown up yet. They haven't fully decided what kind of cells they're going to be. Mm-hmm. And then we separate those stem cells from the T cells. And we save the stem cells to give as part of the transplant. And then we take the T cells, and it's the T cells we just talked about, right? That we need for the anti-leukemia effect. And what we do is we actually genetically engineer those cells, which have T cell receptors that could attack things in the recipient that you don't want it to attack. You only want it to attack the blood cells that are, you know, that are present in the recipient. So we actually edit out the what we say call the endogenous, the TCR that is in the T cells from the donor. And then we insert in a proprietary TCR that's specific for a target that's only expressed in blood cells. And so when we give the stem cells back to the patient, we will also give them the engineered T cells, you know, at or around the same time of transplant. So it's this very kind of like elegant. So what you're doing is by you're giving the patient back the cells that you've now essentially eliminated through the conditioning process, you're also giving them T cells that can help kill the leukemia, and you're giving it at the same time. So you're getting hopefully engraftment, what we call engraftment of the transplant, but the patient's also getting the cells that they need in a safer way, to hopefully prevent relapse.
Next year is sort of your clinical goal.
Yeah. So we're working to file our IND sometime this year. Right now we're targeting the middle of the year. I will say that this is a very complex patient population.
Yeah.
You know, this is in like, if you take a solid tumor setting, for example, right? Like if you take melanoma, for example, and a patient has failed a, you know, standard of care and there's a clinical trial, those patients are able to kind of be enrolled and screened. I've left out a lot of kind of the science that goes into screening these patients, but probably just the screening process for a patient in our study is like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. That's after, you know, that's after site enrollment, you're opening the clinical sites, doing all the contracting, the budgeting work so it's complicated. It's complicated, but you know, I think optimistically we'll dose our first patient in the first quarter of 2024. Hopefully sooner, but I think we'll be well. I'm hoping we'll be well on our way to opening sites and starting to screen patients, you know, by the end of this year.
And I want to move on to TCX-201. Sure. and discuss that a little bit. One more quick question on 101. It's just a question in this sort of therapeutic approach. I'm always curious to get sort of visionary commentary on what down the road, you know, in a commercial setting, what administration might look like, you know, even if it's forward looking to the degree that your investor relations team would not want you to respond. Yeah. Like, you know, kind of pie in the sky, like down the road, when this is common practice, what do you anticipate that administration looking like?
And I think when you think about administration, you think about the patient first, right? And I, you know, kind of told you a little bit about my story. I have a theory that if you put the patient, if you always make decisions that are in the best interest of the patient, that translates into shareholder value and into success in your development. So think about the patient first. Think, one, identifying the right patient population. And I would love aspirationally, you know, when you start a clinical trial, you start, you know, kind of with the sickest patients. Fortunately, because the patients who are at the top and earlier on in their disease don't need experimental therapy yet. I would love to be able to capture some of those 20,000+ patients a year who are not eligible for transplant because it's too dangerous and bring them over to the transplant side, because that is a definitive cure for AML, to prevent their relapse. So when we talk about roughly 3,000 patients in allogeneic stem cell transplants in AML, you know, we'd love to see that number grow. So what does it look like for a patient? You know, the patients are still going to have to go through transplant. The idea is that that experience shouldn't change too much. One of the challenges with transplants, because we discussed graft versus host disease, is it's really this art. If you've never interviewed a transplant physician, a stem cell, a blood transplant physician, it's really fascinating. It is absolutely an art and a science. These are very, very, very sick patients. In terms of a patient experience, so in a traditional transplant, they get what's called immunosuppressive drugs, right? And this is like this art of giving a patient a transplant that can kill their leukemia, but that doesn't have such a graft versus host effect that you have to treat them with all these medications to suppress other types of problems that you're now creating. If we can run a study and create a therapy that minimizes the need for immunosuppression later, it could make I'm not making any claims, but you asked me an aspirational question.
Yeah.
I think to be able to deliver not only a transplant, but a safe cell therapy product that reduces the need to use certain kind of medications, that doesn't require a patient to come back, right, for another infusion. You know, if you think about like a 75-year-old who's, you know, diagnosed with leukemia, just spent 6 months getting, you know, really challenging chemotherapy regimens, who now has to come back and go through this transplant. It's a lot, yeah. Right? So if you don't have to bring that patient back a second time, that's meaningful, I think, for the patient experience. And if down the road we can reduce the type of immunosuppressive drugs that have to be given, that would be a benefit to me also. But ultimately, we want to cure their leukemia, you know, and we want to do it in a way that is kind of as least burdensome on the patient as possible.
Very good. I'm gonna turn the next question or two over to my co-host John, because I'll tell you why. I don't want to put words or attitude in John's mouth, but when I invited him to join me, because I'm like, yeah, I'm coming down to Pittsburgh and you're right there, we got to do this. And John's like, yeah, cool. And then he looked into Blue Sphere, and one of his initial responses was like, wow, these guys are looking to crack the solid tumor nut. And it wasn't a guffaw. It wasn't a guffaw by any means, but it was like, got some questions on how they intend to do that.
It can be, sure. If you want.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think you kind of addressed this a little bit at the top when you talked about needing people who are willing to sort of run through the walls, you know, and, you know, if we see with TCX-201, right, you're looking at solid tumor indications. And on top of that, you know, TCX-101 is an allogeneic drug, which is also, you know, brings, as you talked about, the challenges with immune response and things like that. So, you know, one of the first things that I thought was, this young startup, you know, really 5 years old.
Yeah.
You know, came out of a great institution, but why should Blue Sphere sort of be the one to figure that out when Big Bio is throwing, you know, so much in research dollars after these kinds of indications?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. So let's take just stay on the hematologic blood-based.
Yeah, I think it speaks to like a sort of a mindset too, right?
Yeah. Look, I think, you know, we talked about earlier, like, okay, if you're a drug developer, where do you start? You know, do you go after pancreatic or glioblastoma, or do you go after something where you think you might be able to have a quicker win so you could eventually get to those? But it's like, whenever I see somebody do a pancreatic trial or even more so, like, you know, glioblastoma, where there's been very little advancement.
Yeah.
It's, you know, in just period, especially in pediatric indications. It, it does take a lot of guts to do that. I think for us, AML has been really hard, has been a tough indication. And we've heard this from big pharma that we've spoken to and investors like, God, we can't get those patients to stop relapsing, you know, those in that population. And when you're a drug developer and you're like a senior executive or drug developer, you don't always have a choice, right? Sometimes you inherit a trial. So at our last company, we inherited a melanoma study. It's like, it's pretty tough to make a pivot of like, okay, well, we're going to not do melanoma now. We're going to go do lung or sarcoma or breast, you know, something to it. It's hard because that study then starts to identify you, right? Like once you become a clinical stage company, that's all people want to hear about is your clinical data. So you kind of have to understand when you stop becoming a development company and when you start becoming a clinical company, right? And there's usually no going back, right? Yeah. And so your question about leukemia, John's a really good one. We just completed a really comprehensive strategic review where we went out to people all across different sectors. So investors, clinicians, transplant coordinators, payers. And we really pressure tested this concept of using these minor histocompatibility antigens or MIHAs, which is the class of target we're going after in our first trial. And because we have an opportunity now, because we haven't started the study, to change who we are, right? We're not inheriting something that, you know, I mean, we haven't invested millions of dollars yet, but it's not too late to turn around because we're a platform company. We could pivot tomorrow and develop a panel for KRAS or P53, you know, and in 12 months or 14 months, be ready to go to the clinic. And everybody came. And so we sort of, you know, you always like your own thing, usually.
Yeah.
Right. But you want to hear other people say that they like your thing. And that's what we heard. And I think it's the approach that I described before. Now, again, it's a challenging approach because there's a lot of things that have to go right. And we feel that we have the team. We do have the team to do it. But I think there's an elegance in our approach to the combination of using a CD34 selected transplant in combination with an engineered TCR or TCR T cell product that is only going to target hematopoietically restricted targets. So you are going to get the graft versus leukemia effect while minimizing your risk of GVHD and hopefully need less immunosuppression. You know, our preclinical data seems to indicate that will work, you know, in mice, and the work that we've done seems to indicate that will work. And so, you know, to the extent you can have a high degree of confidence before you actually put it into a human, you know, if you ever have anybody sit in this seat who tells you their drug is going to work before they've actually put it into a human, you know, you should probably ask them some follow up questions.
I've done interviews like that. A couple of those guys are in jail now.
Right.
I'm not even joking.
Yeah. Look, it's really important. Lie. It's really important to have preclinical data and have a good, and I think your question's like, you know, I'm not a doctor, but we know that AML is one of the harder, you know, myeloma's got a whole list of treatments that you can get to and through, including autologous transplants, which are less dangerous and probably easier to do, even though they're still risky. So your question's spot on, right? It's like, why wouldn't you take some lower hanging fruit? We are going to, like I said, we are going to announce a bridging program in solid tumors. That's not personalized, that will likely be autologous, easier to manufacture, that will likely be, you know, hopefully delivered in combination, you know, with another therapy. So that will diversify us a little bit. Nothing's easy in oncology or cell therapy, and nothing works every time. So
yeah,
I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
just to wrap things up, what happened? And we can't, I mean, we could spend the entire day talking to kind of get the full breadth and depth, but what haven't we asked you that you feel like, boy, if he were a better host, he certainly would have asked me this.
No, I think you covered it all, and I don't want to give our company and our technology too many shameless plugs here. But you know, there's a lot of people out there doing things that look similar or close. And, you know, when you're a patent lawyer, although no patent lawyers will probably admit this to their clients, but you know, it's like nobody ever invents anything new, right? There's only incremental changes. I don't know that our space is the same, right? Like there are other TCR companies. Obviously we think we're the best, you know, we think we can do it faster and we think our clinical approach is best. But you should pressure test our data when it becomes public and when we get into the clinic. That's what drives our business. And I do think we're differentiated. I definitely think our clinical approach and our first indication is differentiated. I think we didn't talk too much about it, but I think our kind of aspirational TCX-201 program in solid tumors could be really revolutionary. You know, it's this concept of, you know, everybody's tumor makeup is different, right? You could, hopefully not, but like, you know, we could both walk into the doctor with the same diagnosis and have a very different tumor profile, right? And it's by going after these tumor specific neoantigens that are specific to the patient, which is nothing new, right? Neon, Gritstone, BioNTech, we did it at Vaxis. You know, I think there's recognition in the field that that's a very ripe area for discovery, albeit fairly nascent. Mm-hmm. There was just some interesting vaccination data that came out that was promising. But this concept of like really examining what's in the patient, what's tumor specific, right? And when you sample a tumor and you cut it open or there's heterogeneity within a single tumor and there's heterogeneity between that tumor, what we call truncal and then, you know, disseminated or metastatic lesions. There's differences in the makeup of those tumors. And so then you get into the T cell response. So being able to isolate and select the right neoantigens from a patient's tumor and marrying that with our TC Express platform, which are actually the TCRs that we're pulling from that patient, mm-hmm. and saying, well, okay, here are the tumors that we think are ripe to target in a particular patient. And we know that they could be immunogenic because we've now matched them with a T cell receptor from a T cell from that patient's own body, expanding those and then redelivering them to a patient. It sounds very futuristic, but we're like on our way to doing that now. It's early days, but you know, we've had some interesting initial proof of concept. Now it's a couple of years from the clinic, but I think it's important for companies like Bluesphere to also have an aspirational program as long as you stay focused on what your core value drivers are in the present. You know, you don't try to do too many things, but our programs overlap and that, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, that could be very, very meaningful for patients and for Bluesphere.
Very good. John, did you have anything else for?
No, I'm good.
You're good.
Yeah. Thanks. It's been great. This is fun.
Yeah, I
this
thought so. I thanks. Yeah. Again, thank you for all the time. John, thanks for
it was
joining
great to
me
meet you both. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Co-host, all right.
We appreciate it.
Look forward to hearing.
Oh, and by the way, next year, like when you're in the clinic and perhaps later in the year, when perhaps there's at least some hints of data, I'm hoping you'll have us back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It would be great to update you and, you know, see the progress. We're all about progress. We've got to keep it moving forward.
That's right.
Urgency and quality. That's the motto.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for having us down here.
Take care. Yep.
So that's Bluesphere Bio CEO Kier Loiacono and Bioprocess Online Executive Editor John O'Connell. I'm Matt Piller, and this is the Business of Biotech in the city of Bridges, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're produced by Bioprocess Online in partnership with Cytiva, which demonstrates its support for the podcast and new and emerging biopharma leaders at Cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Check that out. Check us out at bioprocessonline.com/BOB, where I encourage you to sign up for our new newsletter. And if you like tuning into conversations with biotech leaders like Keir, make sure you're subscribed. Leave us a review and some feedback. And as always, thanks for listening.